ridiculous. It's like they're not using Twitter and like tweeting like, strap some dynamite on my chest today, going for a stroll, hashtag bombing Thursdays. This is The Impromptu on Hologram Radio, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. I'm Alex Knight, and I'm joined by Chief Executive Officer Michael Norton and special guest this week, Kelly Guimont.
Hey.
Did I get that name right?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, you didn't try too hard, and that's usually what I get is somebody who tries to make it extra French sounding, and it really isn't.
Right.
I can imagine. Guimont.
Yeah, I get a lot of, oh, Mrs. Guimont. And then they start yammering at me in French, and I'm like, nope, nope, nope. Could you not tell by the first name Kelly that I may be married into this? Like, come on.
So there are a bunch of stuff that came up this week. Some of it technology related. The ongoing debate amongst both, well, from technology companies and the government about creating backdoors and putting an end-to-end encryption. And there's a bunch of other stuff going on. But where do you guys want to start?
I think we should start with the trolling that is going on in Kelly's backyard.
Imagine that.
What trolling are you talking about?
So if you'll recall, a few weeks back, a militia took control of a government building in Oregon.
Now, please make sure you're pronouncing that with air quotes, because we need to make abundantly clear that, none of the things that make it a militia are things that they are doing. So keep that in mind.
Yeah, they are a bunch of rednecks with guns and decided to commit a terrorist act that no one is calling terrorism.
And well, Michael, white people don't commit terrorism. Don't you know that?
Oh, yeah, no. White people are just fighting for a cause, struggle, so on and so forth.
Now, they don't even live here. This is a bunch of people who came from Arizona and other places. So I just want to make it abundantly clear that it's not like
they're not with you.
A bunch of rednecks in Oregon did not just get bored one day and decide to go take over a bird sanctuary or whatever it is that they're doing. Like, that's not what happened.
And I don't really think Portland is known for their rednecks.
Yeah.
No, they really aren't. But that's the problem, is that I'm from
Handlebar,
the other side of the
Handlebar
state.
Mustaches? Yes.
Yeah, they do. They
plaid?
Did.
Yes.
Absolutely. But basically all the rest of it, no. That's actually why I moved. And like, I've tried to explain to people in the past that if you look at Oregon and Washington, they drew the line the wrong way between the two states. The Columbia River is not what they should have used as the border between Oregon and Washington. You can call them whatever you want to call them, but they should have drawn the line basically at the Cascades, because the side of the state which is nearer to the coast, and this is the same for Washington as well, is, you know, near I-5, is where all of the civilization happens. And by civilization, I mean people and traffic lights and 7-Eleven and all of the kinds of things, you know, having more than one restaurant or grocery store or any of those things. That all happens on the green side of the state, the part where it rains a lot. Same thing in Washington, like Seattle, much nearer the ocean. You know, the part that's green where it rains all the time, that's the part where people live. And then on the other side, it's the wilderness. I grew up on a road that was not paved. I grew up in a town that didn't have a traffic light. And I grew up in the civilized end of the county that I lived in. The south end of the county that I lived in had a high school whose average graduating class was 3. Not 3,000, not 300, 3. 1, 2, 3.
You're making all of this up. No
I'm
traffic light, no paved road.
Absolutely.
Did you have running water?
Yes, we did.
Did you have to travel 6 miles to get to school in the winter? On foot?
It was way more than six, but yes.
Oh my God.
Not always on foot. We didn't have to do any of that. But when I moved about 250 miles to move from the wilderness to civilization. And I may as well have moved to another planet, for as different as one side of the state is from the other. And Washington is exactly the same way, because I know loads of people who grew up in Eastern Washington who have the same view of like the other side, you know, like that's where all the people are. That's where stuff happens. And it's really, really weird. And so, like, I just do want to make clear that, like, yeah, I, you know, because I also grew up before the internet, so it was sort of like living in the wilderness anyway. And then on top of that, like, I didn't live where there were any actual people. So, you know, where I grew up, we had neighbors in the sense that we lived on a piece of property that had a border, and there were people who owned property on the other side of that border. But I didn't live like next door to anyone. Like, that wasn't a thing, because everybody owned like acreage, and your house was in the middle of your acreage. So, you know, we lived on 5 acres. So there was like 2.5 acres in every direction before you saw another house. So,
you're saying that you could be torturing people and no one would hear the screams of pain.
They might, but they would probably just think it was cows. Because there was a biker gang that lived up the street for a while.
Or a coyote.
And I do say up the street with air quotes, because, again, not paved. But yet they used to get on motorcycles and joust with chainsaws, which was sort of funny.
Wait.
Yeah. So, well,
motorcycles and chainsaws?
Yeah, they would get on, you know, like...
That is not a good combination.
No, I'm pretty sure it ended badly for at least a couple of people. But we also lived near the bombing range. The U.S. Navy, oddly enough, had a bombing range out there in Eastern Oregon, and we used to live next to that. So sometimes we could sit outside, because we were a little bit higher up than what the bombing range was, and you could see them fly the night missions, and they would let off these bombs into like car carcasses. Like, they would abandon these cars out on the bombing range, and then you could watch them fly the missions and like drop the big flash bombs so that they could see like whether or not they had hit their target or not. And so you could sort of watch them do that. And like, I grew up not far from actual wagon ruts for the Oregon Trail. So like, when I talk about it being the wilderness, I'm totally not kidding. And I grew up in what was considered the civilized part of Eastern Oregon, and where these guys are is super duper wilderness. So part of the problem is that, A, these guys aren't local. So it's not like anybody's just going to feel like they can go up there and go, you know, Jim Bob, you really ought to just go home and sober up. Like, that's not happening, because they're not locals. So they have no relationship with any of the people who were there. And they've started taking down fences, which is destruction of federal property, which would be a crime if they weren't white people.
This whole thing is bizarre.
Well, here's the thing, is that what they're doing is protesting a guy who committed a crime and went to jail, because he went to jail under a minimum sentencing law. So he served a little amount of time. I'm sure the story is riveting, so yeah. I'll try to just give you the highlights. But what happened was, there was this guy and his son, and they lived in southeastern Oregon, and near Burns is where all of this is happening, Burns, Oregon. And the two of them had set fires. They say that they set fires on their own land, and the government says they set the fires on federal land. What happened was, federal land was on fire as a direct result of fires these two guys set. Now, depending who you ask, there are a couple of versions of the story. If you ask these guys, they say, we set the fires on our own property. We were burning slash, and it wasn't a big deal. And then all of a sudden the wind changed and we accidentally scorched a little bit of federal property. If you ask the government says they were hunting deer illegally. And when you poach deer on federal land, it's an actual crime. And they set this fire in order to cover up the fact that they were doing this. So the two guys went to jail, and they were in jail for, I think, like 6 or 8 months. And then they were released. A federal judge reviewed the case and said, because this was federal land, this is a federal crime. Under the minimum sentencing law for federal crime, you have to go back to jail and finish serving your sentence, because there is a minimum on this variety of crime. So you have to go back to jail for another 3.5 years or whatever it is. So these guys, who you may remember, most of these guys are people who are accustomed to pointing guns at federal agents, because these are people who were part of that standoff with Cliven Bundy.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So this is those guys, and they came here. And the reason that we are all laughing at them is because they came here and they're trying to say that what they want to do is return the land to the rightful owners of the land. And yet they're not talking about the Paiute Indian tribe whose land it actually was.
No, of course not.
No. Because, again, not white people. So they want to return it to the ranchers. I don't know who that is. I don't know why, but they have started pulling down fences, which means they are destroying federal property. And a bunch of these guys have started, like they shot video and posted on Facebook about how like they fully expect to go die in southeastern Oregon. So they've got like these dramatic goodbye videos that they put up because they just know that they're going to get here and the government's going to kill them or whatever.
Meanwhile, the government is just like, whatever.
Yeah. Well, the government won't do anything, which is like, first of all, these guys don't deserve any of the attention.
Yeah.
Like on the one hand, but on the other hand, if this were a bunch of people who were not white, who showed up without guns on any federal property,
the wrath of God would fall upon them.
We don't like a thing that's happening. So we're going to protest by sitting in front of this building. Like, yeah, the wrath of God. Southeastern Oregon would be a sheet of glass because every bomber in the United States would have made a run through there. So
now I don't know that's
frustrating.
The details about the ownership, but why? My question is, why does the government need to own that land?
They don't. It's a reserve. Like, it's not that the government owns it as much as the government put a fence around it and is preserving it. Like, nothing happens there. The government isn't farming it or anything like that. Like, it's just wildlife reserve.
So then, why does the why would the government care if it? What is the issue with giving that land to the ranchers?
Well, because it was land that the Paiute Indian tribe lived on, and then it was officially given to the Paiute Indian tribe by President Grant, which was, 150 years ago or whatever that was. How it ended up being federal land, I don't know, but the point of the government sort of having dominion over it is just to preserve it so that it doesn't get farmed, so that animals aren't raised on it, so that development doesn't happen. Mm. Because in Oregon, we like our wilderness. We
right, that's understandable.
And so this is basically just a preserve. So it's not like the government went and took this from ranchers. That's not what happened. And that was never the case. And so that's why everybody's sort of confused about how these guys are trying to return it to ranchers, because it wasn't theirs.
So then this land really should be given back to the native people.
Yes. If you think that this land is owned by the government in error, then what you need to do is give it back to the Paiute tribe.
Right. Because all of us, like, I mean, the first, even the white people that first came to this country, I mean, we're all guests here, technically.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, really, the fact that we own land, that's questionable.
So start there. And then you get to the fact that these guys, given how military they want us to believe them to be, planned spectacularly poorly for this event. They were very careful to pack up all their guns in the back of their trucks, but no food.
Yeah. So the demand list quickly grew to include how much food? They listed a ton of really specific food. It was like, bring us candy.
But it was like snacks. Like, we want fruit roll-ups and Cheez-Its and, it looked like a six-year-old made that list. Like, quite honestly, it looked like, I just got to spend a week with my niece who is eight. And it looked like a list that she would have made up of, like, if you're going to be home, if you get to pick whatever you want to eat for the next week, what do you pick? Like, it looked like that list. The reason it's funny is because they started holding press conferences and going, please send us snacks. And here's the address. And we would like, we're here because we hate the federal government and down with the federal government. But could you please use the federal government to deliver us fruit leather?
Yeah.
So, and of course, the internet.
That they gave out their address. You can see where this is going.
Yeah. So, well, now, to be fair, the internet was very clear. They did say, please don't mail boxes full of dog poo. Please don't mail inappropriate marital aids. Please don't mail any of these things to this address.
Yeah. Don't. So, don't, you guys.
Yeah. Like, you guys really, I know you think mailing the 50-gallon drum of industrial strength lubricant is funny, but you shouldn't do it.
Yeah, no.
I did see that shipping notice, and it did make me laugh very, very much.
Before we get to that, I just want to point out how incredibly ironic it is that they're making a fuss over minimum sentencing when minimum sentencing almost exclusively affects people of color.
Right. And that's what that's what most of Oregon has been saying. I'm assuming we get more coverage of this than a lot of other places, because we're like, wait a minute, where were you when minimum sentences were sending brown people away?
Mm.
Where were you when minimum sentences were sending any not white person to a prison for a really long time for something that was not necessarily a crime that required that sort of sentence?
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, it has caused there to be a very interesting conversation about federal sentencing minimums, at least here in Oregon. But for the most part, yeah, it's not gone well for them, at least here.
Yeah. So then, people
then
started sending them
yes.
boxes of dildos.
Which is my favorite part.
And then they posted a video asking people to please, please stop sending them dildos.
Stop sending
I
them.
Did not hear about this. So,
oh no.
So who
better.
Found their mailing address?
They posted it.
They posted it on social media?
Yeah.
They had press conferences. They released a statement to the press because.
Here's our address.
Again,
send
bad planning.
For the food thing, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, an address is an
strange.
Address.
Right.
And, you can mail anything you want to.
And
to
they didn't.
Ship there.
To an address.
That's really hilarious that they think nobody would send anything.
Yeah, stop and think that through, dude. Like, if you think that you are alone in this stance and that what you have is such a spectacularly unpopular opinion, maybe don't tell the free world and their Amazon Prime how to send you things that you may not enjoy or may enjoy. I respect their life choices and that's on them. But, you know, come on.
Yeah.
From here as a spectator, it has been really interesting to watch. And this is one of those times when, like, I've been more than happy to let the internet sort of take care of this problem. And just, I'm going to sit over here and make popcorn and watch.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
I would have sent stacks of like framed 8x10 glossy photos, just like a headshot of Barack Obama.
I was trying to figure out like.
Or dreams from my father. Just like 100 paperback copies of Dreams
from
my
Powell's
mother.
Might have those used, and I'm sure they'd give you a deal on drop shipping those from the Quimby warehouse.
Yeah, if they hear what it's for, yeah, probably.
I'm sure they would.
Yeah, we'd like to troll those militia assholes. Oh, yeah, all right.
Sure, what can I do now?
So then, Max Temkin, the creator of Cards Against Humanity, sent them a 55-gallon drum of lube to go with the dildos.
You can get 55 gallons of lube?
Yes, on Amazon.
It's Max Temkin?
Wow.
It's an infamous product on
Amazon.
I
feel like he's, You know, in the last month, I would say overall, Max Temkin is totally coming out ahead in life.
And suddenly all the porn production companies are pissed when they go to place their regular monthly order of lube. And they're like, shit, out of stock.
It's sold out.
It's back ordered.
What do you mean it all went to Oregon?
I know. Yeah, that's all we need is a wave of, that would be great if it just ended up totally screwing up everybody's order. And then Porn Valley comes here and goes and shuts those guys down because they're tired of the internet trolling them. Y'all need to knock this off because seriously, it's putting a serious dent in our production schedule.
And then my personal favorite, my friend Matt Kump, who's a designer at Slack, mm-hmm. he sent them 1,500 live ladybugs.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, that's amazing.
I didn't even know you could buy that on Amazon, but there
it is. You could get ladybugs, but I didn't know you could get 1,500.
Yeah.
Yeah, but who knows if they got it, though, because they could have gone to you can actually go to the post office and say, put a stop on all mail for a certain period of time.
But that's the thing, though. They want things.
Yeah.
Right.
So they're not going to.
So they're not going to.
Yeah. Right.
So
is
I said
this box fruit leather? Oh.
So
is this
I
box
said,
pudding cups? Oh.
So I said if they open it without realizing what it is, ladybugs go everywhere.
I really like that's like when you get those party invitations and stuff that have like all the little confetti and stuff in them.
Yes.
It'd be like that. It would be amazing.
Yep. Then all we need is for someone to send them locusts as well.
I wish I could send them a grizzly bear.
That be nice.
Revenant bitches. They just open the box and rah, rah.
Yeah. In my mind, that's illustrated like an oatmeal cartoon.
That totally sounds like an oatmeal cartoon.
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Those guys. And it's like here, you know, most people are, particularly in Portland, because we're, you know, especially compared to the other side of the state, we're a whole bunch of hippies. There's the camp of people who are like, you know, if they're only getting to do this because they're white people, which is true. And then there's the people who are sort of like having fun with it. And, you know, like maybe we should just leave them alone and it should not be a big deal. You know, what I have started doing, this is my own personal way of trolling them, is I am calling the hotline from the Department of Homeland Security. They have a line for a phone number to call if you have seen something suspicious on federal land or in a federal building. And so I call that number. It is 877-437-7411. And Oregon is Region 10. So I've called them a couple of times now and said, hi, I've been told for the last decade and a half, if you see something, say something. So I'm saying something. Okay, is this an emergency? No. What have you seen? I have seen a bunch of people destroying fences in Harney County, and they are men with guns, and they are on federal land, and they will not leave. And then they're like, have you seen this yourself? I'm like, yes, I've seen it myself. I see it on the news every single night. And then they ask me more questions, and I keep telling them, yes, I've seen this, and no, it's not okay. And according to your own website, this is considered domestic terrorism. So I am calling about it, because if you see something, say something. So I'm saying something. I am doing my part as an American. You are the people who make me take off. I didn't tell them this, but you are the people who make me take off my shoes in the airport. This is the least I can do. So, yeah. So that's what I've been doing, is calling 877-437-7411 and telling them that I'm seeing people doing something bad on federal land. Mm. And as a good American, I am reporting it.
And their response, of course, is an extremely PC version of, oh, but they're white.
No, actually, I get people who are dispatchers, and they have to investigate because I called.
Oh.
So that's why I keep calling, and that's why I'm giving it the number while we're recording, is because other people can call and say, yes, this is happening in Oregon in Region 10. It's happening in Harney County outside of Burns, and it needs to stop. Because this is terrorism, and you should knock it off.
Indeed. Well, we should probably move on. We've spent, I think, enough time on that that terrible, sad topic. But actually, speaking of sad topics,
after this, I'm going to look up every ridiculous thing you can buy on Amazon.
I can't wait to see what they get next.
Sorry.
Well, speaking of sad topics, the ongoing debate and ongoing war against end-to-end encryption continues.
I thought you were going to talk about all the people dying.
No, who cares about that?
I'm like, yeah, let's spend more time on David Bowie and Alan Rickman and Lemmy from Motorhead. Yeah.
And actually, somebody else.
This is Alan Rickman calling. Remember to take the pork chops out of the freezer.
Frost. Do not disappoint me.
Yes, there's two more.
Dan Haggerty, the star of Grizzly Adams.
Grizzly Adams died, and Celine Dion's husband just died.
Yep.
Oh, there's been a lot of that.
Yeah.
They also.
We were actually going to do.
Celine Dion's brother has cancer now as well.
Oh my gosh, I didn't hear that.
It's just like, oh.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we can talk about that just quickly, because it just makes me sad every time I think about it. But Michael and I were going to do a special bonus episode on Tuesday, just the day after the news. But of course, because Michael's vocal issues, we couldn't do it. But I guess we can talk about it a little bit. But I did not expect to get hit so hard when I saw the news. I was actually sitting on the couch watching TV with my girlfriend, and I saw the little push notification show up on my iPhone, breaking news from the New York Times that David Bowie had died at age 69. And I really felt like I was dreaming. I felt like it was a nightmare. I felt like there's no way that this is true, because it was totally unexpected. And
he was already on everybody's mind with that new album, which is great.
Right.
And the new video. And
exactly.
And, yeah.
Exactly. So it was a total shock, I think, to the public, but not obviously to the family, because it sounds like he knew about it for a while, and he was working really hard. He was working really hard to finish that album because he knew he had little time left. But yeah. I couldn't believe that it happened, and I could not sleep that night. I was so shaken by it, and I haven't been this upset about a musician dying. A person that I've never met. I've never been that upset since mm-hmm. Ronnie James Dio died from I think pancreatic cancer or stomach cancer. It's just one of those things where I expected David Bowie at least to be making music for another, 5 to 10 years at least. Because, I mean, hell, the Rolling Stones are older and they're still touring mm-hmm. hard, yeah. right? So, and David Bowie's just one of those guys where you can't, it's so difficult. You can't really summarize or encapsulate his entire career even in an hour worth of podcast. It's just, I think he had something like 28 studio albums, just a massive career total. He's been called a chameleon in many respects with his music. His music has evolved over times. I think one of the actually reasons why I respected him so much was not only because he was so versatile as a musician, I mean, especially by the fact that he was always constantly searching for inspiration, and he was someone who listened to new bands and respected a lot of new music that was coming out, and actually pulled influence from a lot of modern music. And so he's experimented with all sorts of other different sounds. He's experimented with electronic sounds mm-hmm. as well, with that Earthling album that he did in the 90s. So he's so versatile on so many fronts. I mean, he had an impeccable style, which always changed, kind of like Madonna. So, he was a good actor. I enjoyed, pretty much anything mm-hmm. that he was in, even though he didn't do a lot of acting. I always enjoyed the roles that he played. Obviously, Labyrinth comes to mind. That's one of his most popular ones.
Yeah.
But it really hit me hard, and I'm not like, I wouldn't say I'm the most like obsessive big David Bowie fan, but I enjoy his music, and I'm mm-hmm. not super familiar with a lot of his catalog, but I have listened to some of it, and I suspect now I'm actually going to be a bigger fan now that I'm actually going through and listening to all of his older albums and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, but, and they're so different.
I think
that was the other thing about it. Somebody, and I can't remember who, but this was one of the things that really stuck with me on Twitter. Someone said, just like Doctor Who, everyone has their favorite David Bowie. And I was like, oh, ha ha. And then I was like, wait, that's actually totally true. Cause there's like Ziggy Stardust guy. And then there's like the 80s pop guy. And then there's like Labyrinth. And then there's the Glass Spider stuff and Tin Machine. Tin Machine was a different guy. And then he went on tour with Nine Inch Nails, and that was a different guy. And then like went back to solo albums and like just sort of throwing stuff out there. And like the stuff at the end of his career sounded very different than the stuff at the beginning, but it always sounded like David Bowie.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And like that was the thing that I thought was really great. There was a quote from the guys that do the Venture Brothers cartoon. And because David Bowie was on that show. Like, I mean, he wasn't, but they portrayed him on that show as like a very high-ranking person in the world, which was really funny.
The sovereign.
Yes, he was the sovereign. It was awesome. They did a whole scene of like an actual guy whose name was Major Tom, who was in a. Before last week. It was hilarious. You know, now it's sort of sad. But one thing, and I went and pulled it up because I was looking for it. Doc Hammer is one of the guys that does the Venture Brothers. And he said, he's more than a human being. He's this thing that we've all had since childhood. None of us got to call him up and have lunch with him and stuff. And that hasn't changed. There's so much of David Bowie that lives in us that never goes away. I think his influence is immortality. He lives in anybody who has a fucking idea about culture. At least we have that. He gave that to all of us. And I thought that was really interesting, because then he also said, you know, some 14-year-old next year is going to find out about David Bowie and his world is going to change just like ours did. And we never got to sit with David Bowie and have him affect our lives as a person. We just had the deeds and the promise of him. He's so much bigger than life that he's bigger than death.
Well said.
And I thought that was really, I was like, there, that's it. That's the thing that I was trying to say. So like, that was kind of how I felt about it. Like, to me, you know, because like the stuff that I think of about him is sort of like, you know, he lived on his own terms and he was, you know, like, people talk about the Glass Spider tour all the time because it was this big failure, but you know, he was doing interesting stuff. Maybe it wasn't what anybody liked, but he was trying something new. And then, you know, it worked or it didn't. And when he was done with that, he went on and tried the next new thing. And, you know, Station to Station is a very, very different album than Earthling or, you know, the Tin Machine stuff that he did, you know, and none of that stuff sounds like Ziggy Stardust and none of that sounds like Black Star. And
but I think that was part of the appeal of David Bowie,
yeah,
as an artist.
Yeah.
Right. Because everybody has that David Bowie song they exactly. like, whether they realize it or not.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, especially for a new generation, there's going to be, I think there's a David Bowie for everybody, no matter what style of music you like, whether you like hard rock or industrial, electronic music. There's always a little bit of that, of all mm-hmm. those different styles in his music over his entire career, which is why I think everybody should go back and listen to all of his stuff if they haven't. But, you know, and also as an activist too, and even as a technologist too, I respect him. Because he's just such an intelligent man and such a forward-thinking person. I saw an interview back in 2000 that he did actually about the internet. And they asked him about, you know, what his thoughts were on you know, what the future of content will be like. And he was very prophetic with how he actually looked at the internet. He said it was a completely different beast and people are totally not really fully realizing its potential. And he said it was going to change the game for content and how people mm-hmm. consume that stuff. And everything that he said in that interview has come true.
He started an ISP in like 1998.
I found out about that recently. Of his other weird business ventures. I just couldn't believe it.
Oh, I had an email address there for a while because I was like, hey, somebody else who
wasn't
sees
it Bowie
potential
Net?
In this. BowieNet, yeah. Yeah. And it was, I mean, it was
now,
cool.
Where was this ISP, though? Was this an American ISP?
Yeah. I don't know if it was anywhere else, but it was sort of like, you know, you could sign up for AOL. It was when you still had to call a phone number and do all of that. So he started BowieNet and, you know, was doing all of that and, like, you know, streamed stuff online and made his music available there. And there was so much stuff that he did, you know, that way. And like, and he was always kind of that activist guy. Like, the one that sticks with me is an interview he did with MTV very early on, like, I don't know, 84, 85 or something. And he basically sat down with MTV and I want to say he did the interview with Mark Goodman, looked Mark Goodman in the eye and was like, how come there are no black people on MTV?
Like, yeah, that was a big, that was a famous thing for
him. Yeah, that was huge. And like, people now, you know, sort of, I mean, it's sort of weird to think about that today because like there's really no music on music television anymore. But at the time when it was basically a radio station that included video, you know, it was really a problem. And so it was really, you know, the moments like that come out that people talk about. It's really interesting to me to see how, you know, he always was sort of out there, you know, trying to do what he thought he could do in order to right a wrong. And I was always really struck by that, no matter what music he was making or how interested I was in it at the time. So I got to see him on tour, actually, once. I saw him on the tour with Nine Inch Nails. And it was basically like a sort of a doubleheader show. Like, you saw, like, they sort of played, they sort of opened for each other. Because, like, you got Nine Inch Nails for a while, and then you got David Bowie for a while, and then you got both of them for a while. And it was an amazing show. And I remember standing there and not being a huge David Bowie fan. I was mostly there to see Nine Inch Nails. And he played like two songs, and I was like, this show is great. He is amazing. I need to do everything in my power to try to remember what's happening. Like, I'm trying to record it in my brain to preserve that, because I didn't think I was going to get an opportunity to see him again. And I don't think he ever came back to Portland. That was sort of what really struck me as a performer, you know, was listening to him play all this music, you know, and he's playing all these songs that are from, you know, well before I was born, and, you know, and then some of the stuff from the 80s, and then collaborating with Trent Reznor on stuff, on some of the Nine Inch Nails stuff, and getting to hear how all of it, like I said, all of it sounded like David Bowie, even though all of it was really, really different. And it was really an amazing event to get to see. So that was one thing that I always, like, when people talk about, like, you know, what great show have you been to, like, that's always one that's near the top of my list.
Yeah, I wish I was a bigger David Bowie fan earlier on, when he was still touring regularly, because that's the, mm-hmm. that's my biggest regret, is not being able to actually see him live. That would have been real treat, and it's sad. It saddens me that I'll never have that opportunity now.
Yeah,
but
I did like what Simon Pegg said, which was, you know, given all of the time of human civilization, like, at least you got to exist at the same time as David Bowie.
Yeah, I saw that. That was really nice.
And I thought that that was really great.
Indeed. Yeah, there's been 2016 not off to a good start with so many people, people of creative influence. And I just heard that, I don't know much about her, but I don't know if either of you remember a few years back, the lead singer of the metal band Static died. And now his wife, Tara something or other, just committed suicide.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was a pill overdose, and she left a note, apparently.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, she was 33.
Wow.
I posted on Facebook. It really bothers me when I hear stuff like that, because I've lived with people that have suffered from depression, like, seriously chronic, like, clinical depression, and I have friends that have, you know, have had rough patches and stuff like that in their life, and it just saddens me that, you know, mental health is such a critical thing, and so many people lack empathy for people that have depression. There are many people that don't really fully understand it, because they maybe haven't read a lot about it, or they've never known, or at least lived with somebody who has had it. So they just, you know, they just think, well, you know, if you're just feeling sad, just stop feeling that way.
Mm-hmm.
Just, why don't you just leave the house and just get
just
over
feel,
just get
feel
over
better.
It.
Like, you'll get over
it's
it.
It's not
just
a switch that you can flip. Like,
absolutely not. Mm. And it's heartbreaking, you know, particularly when it drives someone to feel like the world would truly be better off without them, and they end up succeeding in that. Like, that's really, you know, to feel like you are in that place. Like, I've never felt that way, but I can't, because, and I can't imagine it, but I can't imagine feeling that way and also sort of not having it taken seriously. Like, I've been in that place where somebody, you know, wants to, like, you know, I want to be comforted. Like, you know, I'm really sad about something, or I'm really worked up about whatever it is. And, like, what I really want for you to do is sit down next to me and hold my hand and say, that sucks. I'm sorry. What can I do? You know, and maybe all I need for you to do is just, you know, pat me on the shoulder and, you know, or put your arm around me and say, you know, I really wish I could help you, or I wish that there was something I could do, or, you know, something like that. Like, you know, because that may not improve my situation, but it might make me feel better. You know, like, mm-hmm. I've tried to do this. I've tried to explain this to my husband. Like, if I'm really sick, like, sometimes all I want for you to do is just come in and say, this really sucks. I wish I could help you feel better, because that will make me feel better, even if it doesn't alleviate my symptoms. It may not bring down my fever. It may not keep me from being nauseous. It may not keep me from being unbelievably congested and sneezing every 90 seconds. But, you know, it will make me feel better that somebody is trying to care about me. And I want that for loads of people, because I don't think mental illness is a thing that a lot of people put a lot of stock in, even still.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, too, where I think, you know, I give people the benefit of the doubt. I don't think most people, especially, you know, your friends and family, I don't think they mean... I think they mean well, but the the problem is, I think too many people try to be life coaches and try to give this unsolicited advice that really is not going to improve their situation.
Right.
And like you said, sometimes just being there for that person and saying, you know, let me know if there's anything I can do for you. Why don't you call me if you're feeling down and let's hang out. You know, and being there for your friends, being there for your family.
You know, you can make a suggestion like, can I, you know, can we sit and watch some TV together? Like, sometimes I don't need you to do anything for me. Just sit there, you know, sit there and hold my hand and, you know, let's watch an episode of Doctor Who or an episode of, you know, whatever it is that is a thing that I generally like. And just sit there and hold my hand, or don't, you know, and sit there with me. And sometimes that's all it takes. And like, you know, and like sometimes when I'm sick, that's what I want too. Like, you know, I'm making it sound like I'm sick all the time, but I'm really not. I just get really bad sinus infections and I lay in bed and wish that there was, you know, some sort of attachment I could put on the shop vac and suck it all out of my head and feel better. And so, you know, sometimes really all there is to do is just sort of, you know, sit there and hold my hand and be like, let me see if I can find something on Netflix that, you know, you might enjoy almost being able to hear, you know, while you fall asleep. Okay, let's see if we can just work that out. And I, you know, and it's hard sometimes. And, you know, you may feel awkward if you know somebody who is clinically depressed or is manic depressive, you know, and on a downswing or whatever. And, you know, sometimes all you can do is physically sit there with them. You know, let's watch some TV. You know, let me make you a sandwich, you know, some small thing. And, you know, you never know if that's going to be the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's so many things that need to be done, I think, with mental health, like having, I think it has to start early on. I think there's more that we can do in education and in school and stuff like that to provide support services for people.
And I think that's one of the big problems where people give this unsolicited advice, because it's like they mean well, but they don't really know what they're talking about. They don't.
Right, they have no tools.
There's no understanding of mental health, because our society prefers that nobody deal with it.
And I don't know what it's like in schools now, but I know when I was in high school, I can tell you, and this is not just my own anecdotal sort of opinion, but I know from many other people that would generally say that school counselors are not great. And I think they need to be specifically trained in understanding depression, in mental health issues. I think if they understood, if they understood that and they were trained properly how to handle it, they would be more well equipped to speak to kids and actually help them out and possibly catch warning signs of someone's possible self-destructive behavior.
Well, and figuring out, you know, what the line is between, you know, I'm 16 and I'm swimming in hormones and I don't have any tools myself to, you know, nobody equipped me for what this was going to be like. And, you know, and I'm 15 and I'm mad at everything all the time. And like, you know, I've got zits everywhere and hair everywhere else and what's happening. And like, there's a difference between being that kid during finals week, you know, and someone who is mentally ill. And really needs actual assistance, actual help, more than just, you know, what most people's experience with a school counselor is. You know, like a lot of people, I think, Now, of course, I'm not going to remember his name, but the counselor on South Park in the school. Drugs are bad.
Mr. Mackey.
Mr. Mackey. Like, most people's school counselor experience, I think, is Mr. Mackey. And, like, when you're in high school, sometimes all you need is Mr. Mackey. But not everybody is that kid. Not every kid is that kid. And being able to tell the difference between, you know, you just need talked down off a crazy puberty ledge and, you know, you are showing symptoms of clinical depression, like that even recognition seems like it would make such a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I was pretty much that kid. Like, I was bullied a lot and it caused issues. And for the most part, the school treated me like I wasn't a victim, basically.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I got bullied when I was in high school. Absolutely. So,
and
yeah, I started throwing
my GPA. They swear up and down, oh, this is a serious problem and we're going to do something about it. They do nothing.
Yeah.
They do nothing.
Yeah. Or what they do is they pull in the kid who's bullying you and they're like, you're not being nice. Could you not? You
know? And then, yeah.
Then they're like, worse to you.
Victim blaming is my biggest pet peeve in high school. I remember, and this didn't actually happen to me specifically, but I've heard, I know people that this has happened to, and I've heard other stories where the person that's actually doing the bullying, yeah, sure, they'll get sent home or whatever, but they also punish the victim.
Yeah.
And they always say, well, it takes two to start an argument, and you know, they'll send both people home. Like, well, that's sending the wrong message.
Exactly. Yeah.
And if I was a parent, because I would be pissed off about
yeah,
that.
Like, I got suspended for like 3 days because I had finally had enough and I said something to my bully.
Yeah.
And then they went and told on me and mm-hmm. I got in trouble.
And oftentimes it is nothing. It is absolutely nothing to do with the victim. Oftentimes bullies, they're not, you know, they have their own issues and there's never an excuse to be violent. And I remember, I'll never forget this, but like, I was not a kid that got picked on, luckily. You know, I was kind of like, I wasn't one of the popular kids, but I was kind of like just neutral. Like people said hi to me and they didn't have an issue. But I remember one time in, I think it might've been grade 11, where I was just in between classes. There was basically no one in the hallway, and I was just walking down the hallway, and these two guys were coming towards me, and I walked in between them, and one of them just tackled me to the ground, just basically shoved me to the ground, and he walked away without saying anything, and his friend, like, I could tell his friend was like trying to control him, because I turned around and I said, you know, what the F is your problem? And he came up to me and he grabbed me and choked me and he said, do you know who the hell I am? And I said, I don't give a shit who you are. But his friend was like, come on, let's go, and finally managed to pull him away. But he obviously, something happened to him that day where he was like visibly upset, but he decided to take it out on the first person.
Yeah.
That is not healthy behavior.
Nope.
No, not at all.
Luckily, I didn't get sent home that day. But
yeah, I was gonna say.
But I mean, that stuff happened. But that stuff happens all the time. But they did ask me. They're like, "Well, what did you say to him?" Yeah. I'm like, "I didn't say anything. I'm walking there, and the idiot decides to tackle me."
Oh man, that sounds so much like what were you wearing?
No, I was just gonna say, like, now pretend you're a girl who has spent your whole life being told, "Be good, be quiet, go along to get along." You know, whatever it is, I'm sure it's your fault.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
and
sometimes
now,
they even say, like, the dumbest question is, well, were you looking at him? Like, oh, I can't even look at people now?
Yeah. And, you know, because this happened to me. Like, you know, when I was bullied, like, I knew better than to say anything. I didn't say anything to anyone. There was no way that was going to happen. I just started sabotaging my GPA so that they wouldn't make fun of me for being the 4-point kid anymore. And so I literally started skipping assignments and putting bad answers on tests and knocked it down to a 3-point, which was more A's than B's, which was all I was really looking for, and started doing that, you know. And of course, I know now, you know, that was a ridiculous thing to do, but it kept me from continuing to get hassled because there were other people who had better GPAs than me. And so then they became targets instead of me. And so I got to fly under the radar, and it was the worst. And I hated feeling like that. And I hated feeling like I couldn't speak up because I knew other people who were getting bullied, and I saw how those conversations went. And it was the same sort of thing you guys are talking about. You know, like, what did you do to antagonize this person who everyone in school knows has been shoving kids into lockers since we got lockers in seventh grade?
Yeah, it's just, this is a systemic issue, you know? That and yeah. I don't even know where, yeah. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know, but we need to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And that is definitely training people to not victim blame. At the very least, at the very least, do not blame the victim.
Right. And then follow that up with take what they're telling you at face value. Don't spin it out of control. But when somebody tells you every Tuesday morning, you know, when I go from this class to that class, this person shoves me into a locker. Okay. I'm going to take that as fact, that you're eating a locker Tuesday morning. Now, take that piece of information and don't automatically assume either that this person is on a violent rampage or that the person who has told you this is lying to you. Take it at face value. This is a thing. I'm going to assume it happened because you went out of your way to tell me about it. So now, let me see if I can find out what happened.
Well, this is a problem too with people in authority, because I remember there was a, I don't remember what show it was, but I don't know if either of you saw it, where Patrick Stewart is tracing back trying to find out more information about his father.
Oh yeah.
And because he grew up in an abusive household. His father basically came back from the war with PTSD, although like they didn't have a term for it. They didn't know what PTSD
they almost
was.
Almost called it shell shock.
Right.
In the olden days.
But
yeah.
He was not the same, and he was a very abusive person to his mother.
Yeah.
And Patrick Stewart recalls vividly one time when the police actually showed up. And the first thing that they asked his mom was, well, what exactly did you say to your husband? Yeah. As if to say, well, there, obviously, is there an excuse for violently abusing somebody just because you said something? Like, that doesn't give somebody the right. Like, I could call you an asshole, and you don't know me from anywhere. That doesn't give... like you a right to like punch me in the face. That's right. Freedom of speech. You can just, you know, be a human being, be a better person, and just ignore that person.
Right.
But, you know, use your words like an adult. You don't need
or maybe
to like
stop being an asshole and then people won't call you that.
Right.
I mean, I know that's insanity, but you know, you could try it and see if maybe being a little nicer to somebody,
yeah,
you know, changes anything. I know there is a UK show called Who Do You Think You Are? And occasionally they do it in the US too with some celebrities, but it started out as a show in the UK. So it might be that. Because I know that that's a show that where people trace back their family trees and stuff. So I don't know if that's the one that it was on, but I think those are sometimes really interesting because you never know how things are going to turn up. But yeah. I also know that as a result of his childhood, more or less, Patrick Stewart does a lot of fighting for abused women and for abused kids and, you know, people who end up in these abusive relationships. And partly it's helping get those people out of those situations, but it's also partly trying to help those people stop being abusers, because that's sort of important too. And it's interesting to see every once in a while something will sort of bubble up, like, he was in this place and somebody asked him something and he said this particular thing about, like, you know, when I was a kid and you know, my dad was an abuser. And so like that has informed my worldview in this particular way. And every once in a while, something comes out like that. And he's a very, very well-spoken man. And it's always really nice to see somebody who sort of has some perspective on it, you know, and you know, he's not just saying it because it sounds good. He honestly came from an abusive home and, you know, was able to overcome that. And so it's always interesting to see. If you look him up, you'll find that a lot of the stuff that he is quoted as saying, a lot of that is stuff about like women's rights and, you know, what you can do for people who are in bad situations and how to help people get out of them and stuff.
Yeah, it's a good thing that he's doing. I wish more people actually
yeah,
did that kind of thing, contributed.
Yeah,
but yeah. It all comes down to, I think, education, and you know, I think it's such a systemic issue. But I think the only realistic way to tackle these issues are to, you have to start, I think, in your own community.
Yeah.
By speaking up, and that's where it needs to start. Because I think even one community can implement a better training program for school counselors to help out kids that are, suffering from depression or show signs of violent behavior, even like helping the bullies actually figure out what, like getting to the root cause. What is the issue? What is causing this behavior?
Right.
Right.
They're acting out for something.
Right. I mean, sometimes obviously there's a very small percentage of people that are actually, you know, psychopaths, but oftentimes it's the environment that they're actually growing up in. Maybe they have an alcoholic, abusive father, and they're just acting out. Maybe there's some issue in their home life, but yeah, getting down to the bottom of that, you need people well trained for that kind of stuff, and I just don't see that happening.
No.
But
yeah. And you need it, like a line needs to be drawn, you know, and if it's this summer between school years, you know, and it becomes like this thing where from this year forward, you know, school counselors are better trained and they're able to recognize the violence in a kid, because maybe if you can recognize the violence in that kid and find out what's going on with that kid's home life, and you can find out a little bit more about a kid, you know, because whenever you look back on some of these kids in retrospect, you know, who ultimately end up taking a gun to school because they think that's the thing they need to do next. You know, this could head a lot of that off if it were possible for people to sit down and pay a little bit more attention and have the training and have the compassion and have the tools to be able to recognize some of that in somebody. Because you can always go back afterwards and piece things together, you know, and if this, you know, if this kid is the kid who's shoving someone into lockers every day, you know, find out more about what's happening with that kid. And it's not just sit them down and look them in the eye and ask them. Like, there's a lot more to it than that. And, you know, sometimes maybe all it takes is just a little bit of interest, you know, no one at home, you know, cares about the kid at all or whatever. And so this is the only attention they can get, you know, and that's like not the best, you know, that's not the best tactic for that sort of thing. So if there were a way, like just draw a line and decide like this is going to stop. And, you know, if you know someone who is bullying other people, if you know someone who treats women poorly, if you know someone who is doing any of that, you can call them out on it, and you don't have to be Nancy know-it-all and like lecture them, you know, like I've called people out before. Hey, that wasn't cool. Knock it off, you know, and that's it. And you don't have to do any more than that. And if it's something if it's behavior that you are continuing to see and it doesn't change and you've called somebody out on it and it doesn't make a difference, then maybe stop being friends with that person. You know, there are things that you can do. And if enough people were able to do that, then somebody would look around who's, you know, kind of an asshole and go, gosh, I wonder how come I don't have any friends. Well, maybe it's because everybody who was trying to hang out with you tried to tell you that you were doing this thing, and it turns out you're kind of an asshole, and so none of them want to talk to you anymore. Maybe you should stop being an asshole.
Yeah,
well said. We're coming short up on time. Do either of you maybe want to get into the encryption debate at all?
Of course I do.
Yeah.
So The Verge actually published a very interesting article, I thought, on the debate that's happening right now in Congress, especially with the FBI. The article is written by Russell Brandon, and it's actually titled "The Five Big Lies of the Encryption Debate." Now, I don't know how either of you feel, but I am definitely not buying this whole thing that we need to give up our privacy. The overwhelming majority of people need to give up a bit of their own personal privacy so that the government can have a back door into just mass data collection, which there is absolutely zero evidence, zero, that will make any kind of a difference. And I think this article gives plenty of reasons why. Everything that they're saying is just, it is just not good enough. It is not good enough to warrant this loss of privacy.
Here's the thing is that, and this is a thing that I think a lot of people, maybe they realize it, but are unwilling to admit it. And that is, if you open the door for anybody, you open the door for anybody. Because if you do it for only the government, that's only going to last about 20 minutes, realistically. Like, I know I'm a person given to overstatement, but it's really only going to be about 20 minutes. And then somebody who should not have your information will absolutely have your information. And that's the thing I think a lot of people don't realize. I used to work for a company called AgileBits. They make a program called 1Password. And when you use 1Password, the point of it is that it's an encrypted system and you store all of your information behind what's called a master password. You're supposed to make that a nice, long, relatively complex password, but it's the only one you have to remember because the program will generate other passwords for you. And every once in a while, someone would write in to AgileBits and say, please help me, I forgot my master password. Can you reset it? The answer is no. Because it's not 1Password, it's not AgileBits' information. It's not their information. They don't have anything on servers. They don't have your information. They do not want your information. This is an absolute line in the sand. Like, there's absolutely no way. If you lose your master password, you are well and truly screwed.
Yeah.
Because
that's changed recently with 1Password Teams. Now they actually have like a LastPass style service, but I haven't looked into that. So
Teams
I don't know.
Teams is a different thing if you are actually trying to share them with other people. But for personal use, like if it's just you, you know, they can't reset your master password, and they're proud of that because it's an actual security measure that no one else can get to it. And that's one. And the encryption is open. If you want to find out how the stuff is encrypted, you can. That doesn't mean you can crack it open and look. But one of the things that I think is really funny about this is that having known some security conscious people and some really smart in the security space people in my life, it's fascinating to me to see how transparent and how open a lot of security stuff can be, given that the stuff that is the most open and transparent and the easiest to use is the stuff that is the hardest to actually get into. And it sounds like they are totally at odds with each other, but it's the absolute truth. Like, anybody who's using any sort of encryption method is happy to tell you about it. Here's the method. Here's how it works. Here's the algorithm. If you want to encrypt too, here's how you do that. And, you know, and it's funny to think that if you use the same security mechanisms that some of these other people are using, that you're going to be like 100% encrypted. Anybody who is not you can't get into your information, even though the free world knows all about how that encryption works.
Well, I think it has to be that way. Like, these security technologies have to be vetted. They have to be out there in the wild, open source, in order for them to be completely locked down. If you don't have, like, if we lived in a world with completely, like, everyone's got their own encryption standards and it's all proprietary, there's no way of vetting whether or not it is truly secure.
Right.
And of course, having open standards means it's going to be the most, like, the attack vector is going to be huge, obviously, because, like, that's what's out there. But it has to be that way because people, you have to beat on it in order to really find all the bugs.
But I think that's something that a lot of people don't recognize, particularly if you're somebody who spends a lot of time in security, is that all of the information that you need in order to create security for yourself in your information, whatever that may be, is all out there. And it's all really easy to sit down and read. I mean, some of it's really dry and it's kind of boring, but you can go find it. It's easy to come by. It's easy to read. It's very, very public. Things that are popular encryption mechanisms are absolutely there, out there. They're open source. They're well documented, because if people aren't always trying to break it, then you'll never know if it's broken.
Right.
And that, to me, is the thing that has been interesting about all of this, is because the government is sort of making it sound like all of this stuff is a big, giant secret thing, particularly when it comes to Apple. This is a big secret thing that Apple is doing. And
yes.
Isn't it terrible of them that they're doing this big secret thing, when in reality, it's absolutely not a secret at all.
No.
All it means is that James Comey can't read my text messages. Not that he wants, I mean, I know he wants to, but he's not going to get anything interesting out of mine. But that doesn't mean, because I have nothing to hide is a BS argument.
Yeah.
That's totally not. That's not how it works.
The biggest issue that I have that's been coming from the FBI is, and I'm just going to read a portion of this article here that says, regulating tech companies will help us stop terrorist plots. This is the most powerful lie, the one we heard after Paris and again after San Bernardino. Mm-hmm. If only we could have found out where the terrorists were talking and listened in, the whole tragedy could have been averted. What if digging up a few crucial iMessages could have saved dozens of lives? The problem is, there's no evidence that that is true. Hindsight right. investigations have found lots of tragically dropped leads in the run-up to recent attacks, but mm-hmm. they've mostly been either available information that was ignored or pre-existing flags within the intelligence system. Both the Paris and San Bernardino plots seem to have been hatched in person, leaving as little online footprint as possible.
But then they found the San Bernardino guy. They found his wife posting stuff on Facebook, like publicly yep. to the world.
Yep.
So, you know, I have a really hard time believing this. And part of the reason is because they're trying to make the internet the boogeyman. And the, you know, when you look at some of how this stuff is being put together, like, you know, the internet may make it more convenient, but it doesn't make sure. it, you know, but. That doesn't mean I couldn't call one of you guys on a landline or
yeah.
just, you know, make a phone call.
The other thing that this article, the other thing that this article brings up, which is interesting and something I didn't realize, but now actually seems obvious, is that even beyond specific attacks, there's little evidence of ISIS and other terror groups planning attacks from U.S. owned tech companies. And I think a lot of people are not thinking about that. The one private chat tool that we know ISIS affiliates are using, which is called Telegram, is based in Germany. Cracking open those channels would be significantly more complicated than passing a U.S. law, which is absolutely right. true.
Well, and that's yeah. going to be the next thing, is if you pass this law, these guys that already aren't using iPhones aren't going to start.
And nobody, why wouldn't yeah. they just use burner phones or
exactly.
meet in,
well,
that's exactly or meet in what public?
They do. Yeah.
So
and
it's like
use like $50 prepaid Android phones or
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then yeah. and then, you know, and they're only using those in order to get a hold of somebody wherever they may be so that they can set up a meeting in person where they actually talk about the actual stuff.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't the kind of stuff. And the reason that I find this frustrating is because this is the latest in a long line of air quote security measures. It's the air quote episode this week. The air quote security measure. You know, these are the same folks who are behind the TSA telling me, we actually caught the guy who went about building his bomb, his airplane bomb, so badly that we caught him before he got on the plane. And because he used his shoe, you have to take your shoes off forevermore.
Mm-hmm.
Because we already caught him. Now, if you want me to actually feel safe when I get on an airplane, you're going to implement random stuff. This week, you don't have to take your coat off. But a month from now, you totally have to take your coat off. And this week, we're going to let everybody go through the metal detector. But next week, everybody has to go through backscatter. And this week, all of your liquids are fine. And next week, we're not going to let anything with liquid on the plane, period. And just keep changing it up so that I think that you're actually looking for something that you didn't already find. Because the only yeah. reason we have the things we have now are because they already found that person.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
iPod hair gel bomber is why you have to take makeup out of your suitcase, because that guy was a dumbass. And the shoe bomb guy was a dumbass. But now I have to take my shoes off in the airport every single time. And if they want to actually get out ahead of any of this stuff, those are the kinds of things that need to be changed. And if you look at anything that they're saying about encryption and you look at it as telephones, or you look at it as letters in the postal mail, like these arguments fall over and collapse on themselves. And they should, because they're not actual arguments.
And a lot of this, too, it just strikes me as gross incompetence on their part. It's like, well, we don't want to do actual police work and actual intelligence work. We just mm-hmm. want to read all your mail.
Yeah.
And then it's going to be so easy for us. We don't have to do anything. We can just be like, search all bomb / terror / jihad. Mm-hmm. Enter.
Here's the thing that bothers me. So I understand the need for more security at airports. I mean, I don't like the TSA as much as anybody else likes them, but it is annoying. Nobody likes taking their shoes off, taking their belt off, taking their hat off. I understand all that stuff that happens, but to me, it seems like more probable that if somebody wanted to sneak something on an airplane, they would just pay somebody who, like, is a luggage carrier.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, why not pay somebody that it seems more probable that, you know, somebody that is taking the luggage to the actual plane itself and loading it, or maybe an engineer that's working on the plane. What mm-hmm. about if, and sure, maybe those people weren't radicalized when they were hired, but, it, you know, time and time again, we've seen examples where people have become radicalized much later in life. So who's to say that somebody at the airport, you know, hasn't been involved with ISIS in some way, and now they're getting paid, or for whatever reason they feel obligated to help them out, so they sneak something onto the plane. That to me seems more probable. That right. is where I think the security needs right. to happen. We already have so much security at the airports, and like everybody, like most good people, have to suffer through this crap.
Right.
But it's like there are other ways you can secure an airport. I don't know if they're doing enough for the actual people that are working there.
Luggage handlers don't have to take their shoes off. I guarantee it.
Yeah.
And like and loads and loads of people work in airports. I used to have a job at the Portland airport. I used to work at a coffee shop in the airport, and I had to have a background check, and I had to do all of these things, and I'm sure at least all of the paperwork I had to fill out to get a job at the airport, because I had to have enough security clearance to get to go into sort of like the tunnels and stuff, like the storage areas and things that were like downstairs and behind all of the shops and things. So I had to have like at least enough scrutiny and pass all of that scrutiny in order to be able to go into all of these places, because I had a badge that would enable me to open doors that regular people don't have the opportunity to open. And I get all of that. And that's part of why I find this so frustrating, is because I know what kind of stuff I had to do in order to work there. And I know what kind of stuff, you know, happens in the rest of the airport. Like, I worked with people who worked at the Wendy's that was there, and the people who worked at the other coffee places, and the people who worked at the bagel shop. And like, you know, I knew some of those folks, and like everybody had to go through the same kinds of things. And so right. it seems like, you know, it seems like there's a certain amount of security that you have to go through just to be at the airport in the first place. And that's fine. But I really don't see how reading my email or my text messages is ever going to get you any place. And if any of this stuff was actually working, I think a lot more people would be under arrest. They'd right. be in Guantanamo. Like, if any of this stuff that they were doing now was actually working, we would see more right. of this. Because think what kind of deal they made. The one that I think of is the plot that they actually foiled right before it happened, on a plane from Heathrow to JFK. It was about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe. They caught people who were going to bomb a plane. And it was like a plane on, like, they caught all the people first thing Monday morning, and the plane was actually leaving on Thursday. And I remember this really vividly, because my parents were scheduled to fly from Heathrow to JFK on Thursday. And so, it was crazy. They made my mom check all of her bags. My mom had to check her purse. She wasn't allowed to take anything on the plane. They individually frisked every single person who got on the plane. I understand that. And it was a huge deal that they caught these guys before they were able to do anything to the planes. And I get that. And that's awesome. And I'm glad they caught these guys before something happened. I am especially glad because my parents would have been in the middle of it and that would have been terrible. I was a disaster and for hours because my mom couldn't get a call out from London to any member of my family, to any of us, to let us know that they were fine, that they had been rebooked on a different flight or whatever it was. And so eventually I was able to speak with her and I was like, are you okay? Is everything fine? And she was like, yes, we're fine. We're going to be home. You know, you'll just meet us at the airport at this different time. And, you know, she was explaining to me what was happening. And it was really nice to know that they were able to get these guys ahead of time. But you don't hear that story very often. All you ever hear now is aftermath. So what they're doing now isn't working. And being able to read my text messages isn't going to change that.
Well, and it's, I mean, how naive do you have to be to think that terrorists are using U.S., like common U.S. social networks to, I mean, to plot, it's ridiculous.
You
it's
know,
like,
Apple's
they're not,
market is Syria.
They're not using Twitter and like tweeting like, strap some dynamite on my chest today, going for a stroll, hashtag bombing Thursdays. Like,
yeah, no.
Yeah, boom, boom Monday is not a hashtag on Twitter. You know, well, I remember ages ago, it's been a lot of cell phones ago, but at one point I set my outgoing greeting when they were starting to threaten to listen to everybody's phone calls and stuff, you know, with the warrantless wiretaps. My cell phone, my voicemail greeting said, you know, leave your name, you know, leave a message at the tone and make sure it's interesting because you never know if the NSA can hear you. And my brother called me. And he heard this greeting and he goes, this is Muhammad. I got the fertilizer for the thing. I hope you got the rental truck. Assalamu alaikum. And then he hung up. And I'm like, when I end up living out my days in Guantanamo, I'm telling mom it was all your fault. And nothing happened. Like, yeah, I don't know how you get more obvious than.
Well, just wait till the back doors happen.
Right.
Or no. What is it they were suggesting? It's all encrypted, but we have 9 keys that unlock it.
Yeah.
9 rings to the kings of men.
You know, the other issue with mass data collection is that it's the actual resources that would be needed to sift through that amount of data.
Yeah, you're going to hire me.
I mean,
me
you
to
need
read my
human beings. There are no computers that could possibly sift through that data and make heads or tails of it all.
Right.
So, like, computers, algorithms could possibly help with maybe getting rid of stuff that is very obvious not related to terrorism. But you still need human beings. And I'm sorry, but, like, collecting millions and millions or possibly billions of, like...
Oh, it's already billions.
Messages
possibly
and...
Possibly billions.
Like... I don't know how much data they're collecting now, but I mean, it's already, this information is already out in the public that a lot of the data that they have collected, most of it is just junk.
Yep. Yeah.
And they can't do anything with it. They don't have the people, they don't have the resources to be sifting through this amount of data.
When they do something, it's to spy on people they know.
Yeah, it's never, you know, it's always the ex-girlfriend or the ex-boyfriend or the ex-husband or the ex-wife. It's never, you know, it's never like some dude who came here from Syria and lives in San Bernardino and like we think he might be up to something.
And people are afraid of drones too. I want drones. I want tacos delivered to my house. I want stuff from Amazon delivered to my door.
I want it delivered to Harney County.
A drum of loop delivered by drone. it just
like,
lifts
like
it down.
Drones, like, all, like, straining.
Just above the tree line. Drum.
Good night, everybody.
Well, why don't we wrap right there?
Yeah.
You've been listening to The Impromptu. I'm here with Michael Norton and Kelly Guimond. Now, where can people find you, Kelly? You write stuff online. You podcast.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm still back at drones and 50-gallon drums. You can find me on Twitter as Verso. You can find me on my own show called The After Show with Mike and Kelly. That's at aftershowpodcast.com. You can read stuff that I have to say over at macobserver.com. And occasionally I guest on the Daily Observation podcast from Mac Observer and sometimes on the British Tech Network.
Excellent. Everybody go there and subscribe to all the things.
All the things, yes.
And you can follow us on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. And we're also on Facebook, not under The Impromptu, but you can follow the Hologram Radio page for all of our podcast updates at Hologram Radio, both on Facebook and Twitter. And if you want to support the show, there are various ways you can do that. The first method, you can go to our hologramradio.org webpage and go to donate and send us a couple bucks if you're feeling generous. You can also go to our sponsors page, which is a great way to show your support. We've got Amazon banner links for Amazon UK, USA, and Canada. If you click on those links, we basically get a portion of the sale, no added work on your part. So why not send us some money? And if you have a moment, please leave us a rating on iTunes. That's actually one of the best ways for us to get more people to find our show, because the more people that rate the show, the further up the ranks the show ends up on the iTunes charts. However, that magic algorithm seems to work that most of us don't really understand, fully understand anyways. And until next week...
Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.